to Where Brains Meet Beauty, hosted by Jodi Katz, founder and creative director of Base Beauty Creative Agency.
Hi, Eleni. We recently celebrated your 10-year Base Beauty anniversary. What was your favorite part of the celebration?
Oh my gosh, 10 years. Wild. Well, it was the most special celebration. And thank you to you and Sarah, our COO, and our whole team and clients and friends for making it so special. We had a sneaky sparkle party. There was an invitation on everyone's calendar for a presentation about making our clients sparkle and an opportunity to wear sparkles, which I wear a lot of sparkles, and everyone showed up in sparkles. There were like sparkles and sushi, and it was so special just kind of like thinking back about all the times at Base Beauty, which was so much fun to be celebrated by our Base Beauty family, was reading the kudo board messages. This was something that was not just internal with our team, but it was also sent out to Base Beauty staffers in the past who I've worked with and some who I worked with years ago at this point, and to our clients. And it meant so much to me to see that they took the time out of what I know is a very busy day for them to celebrate this moment. So it was a lot of fun. Such a special milestone. It does not feel like 10 years. It's very much flown by. It was a blast.
Well, right after that party where we had gemstones and sushi and everyone dressed in sparkles to honor you, I jumped on a flight to Disney.
How was that?
It was so fun. We spent the weekend there with our daughter, and I am tired, but I am back at work.
Oh, that's very nice. And got to keep it busy. I feel like that's like one hack of being really productive, and then you get really tired, but it's good to keep it moving.
Well, speaking of that, our clients, certainly they're moving. We have so much prep going on for summer activations. Tell me.
Yeah, we have a lot of clients getting ready for summer sale opportunities. There's Amazon Prime Day in July. So we are gearing up with a lot of content creation and strategy for that support.
We are shooting in the office. It feels like almost every day, every week, right? We're super busy making new content.
Yeah, we are. We have turned into a content studio at the Face Beauty offices. It's very fun to be on set with clients and with our team.
I'm so proud that like 6 or 7 years ago, we had this vision to make our office different than most offices. And with that whole front section of the office turning into a photo studio where we shoot video and photos, I'm really proud of how modular it is.
Yeah, the vision has come to life. Like the hotel seating was so genius. Everybody is collaborative. We are in person. We are able to bring clients in person and use our space for so many different things. There was another really interesting, I think on our last show, we talked about ChatGPT and where this was going in the industry. Tell us about another really cool new network connection you made through this.
Okay. So as a team, as you know, we are learning how to market to AI, right? We've already used tools that have AI to help us in our work, but now we're learning to market to AI so that when someone like our producer, Natasha, asks AI to help her pick out a sparkly lip gloss to go with her sparkly outfit for her next Beyonce concert, that we want our clients' products to rise to the top of that response list. Well, interestingly enough, in the business development cycle, we're already doing this because a brand from overseas actually found us by doing a ChatGPT search. So usually people say they Googled and they found us, but now people are using AI to find us, which is very cool.
It's amazing. Yeah, we are marketing ourselves. I guess that's the work that we're doing as an agency to put our name out there and our clients talking about us online that is getting us pushed up to the top of ChatGPT and AI's list. I love it.
Well, let's move on to talk about our show. We had Kelly Murphy, general manager of Lola, on the show. Lola is one of the first brands ever to make eco-conscious and, I guess, healthier choices around menstrual health products. And she has this amazing background. She's SEO, digital marketing, strategy, analysis. Fascinating woman. And joining her was Taryn Shockley. She's the U.S. Sales and Education Manager at Evolumier MD. And this woman is really fantastic to talk to. She was a serious athlete as a gymnast as a child into her 20s. So I guess you're not a professional gymnast, you're a competitive gymnast. And she now leads talk about skincare lasers and everything, skincare education. Very fascinating.
Yeah, I loved that conversation. Both Taryn and Kelly reflect on the unexpected opportunities and challenges that they face in their careers. Sounds like they both took on roles that they initially felt unprepared for. So that was a really interesting piece to hear about ups and downs of managing a large team and the importance of delegation and professional vulnerability. These are all really interesting topics that come up on this show.
Don't we all take roles that we're unprepared for. I mean, isn't that the point in a sense, right? Like we have our work values, our ethics, our institutional knowledge or industry knowledge. But at this point in marketing, like no one's prepared for anything. You just have to use your smarts and figure it out.
That's so true. Yeah. Having that instinct is something that we really have to look for in hiring these days because the industry shifts and the digital ecosystem shifts on a dime. It's very interesting to watch.
Well, on this episode, you'll hear both Taryn and Kelly reflect on the balance between work and personal well-being. They're both very devoted to their careers, but also like how to find those small wins and support their teams and create an environment where we can celebrate success.
Love it. Okay, let's get to it. Let's hear more from our guests, Kelly Murphy and Taryn Shockley, in episode 285.
Hey, welcome to Where Brains Meets Beauty. This episode, we're on the front lines of personal health with Taryn Shockley, USA Sales and Education Manager at Illumier MD. Hello.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
And Kelly Murphy, General Manager at Lola. Hi, Kelly. Great to see you and meet you here.
Yes, you as well.
So this is a career journey show. We've never met, so this is actually really exciting. We're going to have a fresh conversation. I have no backstory, right? So we're going to learn it all. Taryn, we'll start with you.
Okay.
At the beginning of our careers, we really actually start thinking about this stuff when we're like 10, 11 years old, like our dreams. Yeah. So what was your dream at that age?
You know, it's quite funny. I thought I was going to be a veterinarian, which is the complete polar opposite, but I think I realized with one of my family pets, I was like, oh, I can't do what they actually have to do. Like I thought it was petting the dogs and holding the cats and playing. It's definitely not that. So the dream evolved a lot in completely different field, different place, different this. But I was a gymnast for over 20 years. So really like drive, dedication, willingness, kind of that like eagerness to win. Mm-hmm. So I think that that probably propelled me into where I'm at now.
Okay. I want to dig into that in a minute, but I want to hear from you. What was your like 10-year-old dream?
Yeah, I think 10, 11 was probably about being a writer. I was doing a lot of writing then. I do remember a little bit older, like freshman year of high school, I did a kind of career journey project on, I wanted to be the editor-in-chief of 17 Magazine.
Oh.
Yes. But, and I had a very like full circle moment being in the Hearst building a few weeks ago and like walking in and I started crying.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so, yeah, that always kind of in that kind of like writing realm earlier on.
So when you were younger, were you making your own fake magazines, like dreaming up your own pubs?
No fake magazines. I was writing into magazines a lot with recommendations about what they should be covering and where I think they could make pivots, things like that. But I was mostly writing like poetry, short stories, things like that at that age. Yeah. You know, you're so emotional in middle school, early high school. I had to get those emotions out. Yeah.
Did it work? Did it help?
Yeah, I think so. I remained like pretty stable at that age. Yeah.
So Taryn, let's dig into being an athlete. If you're doing it for 20 years, I imagine you were quite good at it. Very focused.
Yeah, sure.
When did you notice in your pursuit of this, like this isn't just a hobby?
Yeah. So I actually started when I was 2. So I was really quite young and already started competing at the age of 5. By the age of 10, I was what you see on TV. Mm-hmm. So I was presented with an opportunity at the age of 12. Do you want to train for an Olympian or do you want to train to be a college athlete? And there's 2 different routes you take.
Wow.
Olympian, you homeschool, this, this, and this. Not to say that that really reduced any of the hours of practice right. that you do every week. But I had opted to go the college route at that time out of young age before I even pretty much knew what college was.
Right.
Yeah.
What a question to ask of someone that young.
Yeah. You make some really big decisions that young, which is kind of interesting. Of course, led a lot by like your closest family, your other team members who you kind of form that like family bond with, really. And so I think at that age, you just kind of realize like this is the path that I'm going to go on. And the unfortunate thing with gymnastics, clearly it doesn't like carry on forever. Mm-hmm. There is an end point with it. It's not like some other professional sports that exist out there. So you want to make the most of it that you can at that time. And then at the age of 16, signed my letter of intent to go to ASU for a full ride.
Wow.
To Arizona State and carried that through my junior year before I was injured. But hey, it was actually a blessing, trust me.
So let's dig in here because, you know, doors open, doors close, and that's pretty much a theme on this show. Yeah. So you had this path set. I'm sure you had goals like NCAA rankings, I would assume. Yep. Were you able to hit any of those goals before the injury?
Yeah, definitely. So we placed within the top three in NCAA for gymnastics. And at that time, it was the Pac-10, not Pac-12. It was like way better at that time. But we had a really small team, so it was really challenging. We didn't have necessarily the funding that like UCLA has or other Pac-10 schools. And so we had to like really trim, and everybody had to be good at every apparatus, which mm-hmm. wasn't what I had gone into college hoping for. I truly wanted to like not have to do all four events. I wanted to be able to simplify my life and only really practice on the two that I excelled in and loved. But here it is. Mm-hmm. You got to do what you got to do.
This sounds like the job, like work life, right?
Yeah. It definitely is. So it's, constantly pivoting, you mm-hmm. know, to be able to make it work. Which I think is definitely something that I've carried on to my professional career consistently, almost on like a day-to-day basis at times.
Kelly, let's fast forward. What was that first job out of school for you?
First job out of college.
Right? Yeah.
I worked at Penguin, at Penguin Books. And so, yeah, so I was a digital global assistant or something like that, but it very much in the marketing realm. Mm-hmm. So I was supporting the head of digital, and this was 2010. So this was the era in which like digital was like this new thing. Mm-hmm. We were like, yeah, just, you know, you get it, digital. Like, and so, you know, there was a kind of organic social. I remember making, for those of you who remember Foursquare, I remember making like a Foursquare scavenger hunt was part of my job, but also a lot of kind of assistant kind of work for an exec at Penguin. So really fun, very cool, very literally 9 to 5. That was my only experience in New York where I had a true kind of get in at 9, leave at 5 kind of role. A ton of book lovers, and that was definitely a really like lovely environment to be in with other kind of like-minded people who really were just there, not for the salary, certainly, but for the love of books. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at that stage of your career, how do you think you define success? What did that look like? What were you reaching for?
Yeah, good question. I started in marketing, but really what I was there for and what I wanted to do was be an editor. So again, kind of back to that like writing kind of focus. So I think for me at that time, success probably would have equated to, you know, working on really kind of rich texts, you know, and creating great kind of literary work. I think that was the vein that I was in. I think, again, kind of knowing that salaries were low and that I was kind of trying to survive, I think I kind of very quickly pivoted and started trying to learn from, you know, people who I saw kind of scaling through the ranks of, you know, the book publishing industry quickly, and kind of asking them to coffee and trying to understand what were their goals. And that started kind of shifting, you know, some of my perception of how can I marry these two things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Taryn, what was that first job out of school, right? The gymnastics is left behind. You started another path.
Yeah. I actually ended up working for my godmother in LA at a place called Spectrum Gyms. So didn't stray far from the athletic realm, but it was my very first job, which I think is like potentially odd for some to not start until you're like 23, mm-hmm. right?
Well, athletics was a full-time job.
Yeah, right? I mean, you could consider it that for mm-hmm. sure. An unpaid full-time job, an internship. Mm-hmm. But I started there, and it was, I think she kind of wanted to like put me through the thick of it a little bit. So I had like the first shift in the morning that I had to be there at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. I lived 35 minutes away. It was rough, needless to say, to get there, but it taught me a lot about like just getting up and doing the work and kind of like that self-motivating start, which is, you know, extremely vital and important, especially in my industry, because mm-hmm. you're kind of out there like a lone wolf sometimes mm-hmm. when you're managing territories or running other things and talking to physicians on your own. So it was great, but it was, I struggled a bit, I'll be honest.
And how did you transition into the aesthetic space?
Yeah, you know, most people start going to beauty school first and they skip the college thing, or they go to college after. I kind of did the opposite. And I remember my parents being like, wait, you're going to go to beauty school and get an aesthetics license now? Like, you already have your degree. What are you doing? And I was like, no, I love it. And I'm going to want to massage faces, and I'm going to wax brows, and I'm going to open my own place. It's going to be great. Well, I did it. And the second that I started massaging some faces, I was like, oh, this isn't for me. Like, I like the brand side of things. I like getting a facial all day long, but I don't want to be giving it. I'm like, I just don't care enough to make sure you have like the best facial massage of your life. That's well, just
this is interesting. You wanted to massage the dogs and the cats, yes, right?
Not the very true. Love me some dogs and cats. But so, anyways, when I was there, I really excelled in selling product to patients that I was seeing.
And this is actually, I think, one of the hardest things for an esthetician to do.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a little bit uncomfortable. You want to bridge that gap. It all revolves around education and realistic results at that time. But I ended up really excelling in that area, and I could really kind of like amplify my customers' experience as well as drive further results with their at-home care. And so I thought, well, you know, what am I doing here? Why don't I try the next best thing? And so I ended up then moving into a role as a territory manager for a professional brand in Northern California and Nevada. And that was a whole set of new experience. It's one thing to sell to a patient or a customer. It's a completely different thing to sell into a physician, med spa, esthetician, resort spa. That your talk tracks are different. The way you talk about the product, what they value is completely different. And so you really have to kind of learn to be that chameleon and really learn to understand what differentiates your brand that you're working for at that time versus other brands in the market.
So Kelly, let's talk about how did you end up in the women's health realm with these like incredible essentials for our lives, right?
Totally. Yeah. A few different steps. So again, kind of heavy on the, you know, unsustainable salary for living in New York. So, you know, I was at Penguin for 4.5 years. I had an incredible time there. I loved the environment. I still do. But, you know, the salary just wasn't sustainable. I also loved New York. I loved New York more and I wanted to stay in New York. And so I knew I had to figure out some type of pivot. And so I ended up in the ad agency space. And so I got recruited into, they were very much a startup agency at the time, Acceleration Partners. Now they're a pretty well-known affiliate marketing agency. And they were trying to build out an SEO practice. I thought I knew what SEO was. I think they at the time thought they knew what SEO was. We were like, yeah, it's writing. And, you know, it's obviously many more things than that. And so we kind of learned together, but that was my first foray into kind of the ad space, the agency space. And it was a really excellent boot camp for me. So I ended up from there going to Havas, working at Omnicom, working at Publicis, a lot of the big kind of ad agencies in different types of roles, heavy on, you know, SEO initially, UX, and then expanding into kind of data science, data strategy, and ended up with a really nice kind of spectrum of skill sets. Again, kind of ad agencies are boot camps. And so I was able to learn so many different things about kind of marketing, D2C, was able to work on all the P&G brands, all the LVMH brands. And that helped me kind of land once I realized I wanted to go brand side and be able to decide what I was working on and kind of own, you know, what I was working on. That helped me land a role at Pvolve, which is a fitness and wellness company, overseeing e-com there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a lot of steps in our careers, right? It's never linear, except for Dr. Nance, who knew at 10 years old she wanted to be a orthopedic surgeon. But this is very rare. Mm-hmm. What's one of the things that have surprised you the most about the journey you're on? Like if you could, you know, flash and look back, like how did I get here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say it was all luck. I mean, it was like a lot of drive and determination, but I think right opportunities presented themselves in ways that I didn't expect. So it was quite surprising. I have always found myself really confident in whatever role I'm in and thinking like, nope, I'm good here. This is my home. I love this. And then the second that I started thinking that, some other opportunity comes where I'm like, ooh, that looks like a nice, fun challenge. Like maybe I do have that interest there. And so I think there were companies that I was with that I thought I was going to be with for a lot longer than I ended up being there. And not to say that I still don't love those companies and don't love the people behind them and, you know, the relationships I was able to build from them. But, you know, it's kind of just always life is full of those like little pleasant surprises along the way, you know. So at least for me, it's not been linear in that fact.
And it doesn't sound, Kelly, like that you were afraid to take new challenges either. You were at a lot of different agencies, a lot of different opportunities. Mm-hmm. What gave you the confidence to say, yeah, I'm ready for something new?
Good question. I would say that I definitely made a lot of leaps that I wasn't quite ready for, right? But I was so driven, you know, I definitely am kind of an ambitious person and I was so driven just by kind of the belief that, and I think especially when I went from book publishing to ad agencies, that was a huge leap. In book publishing, there's a very specific kind of And it's different now, I think. But at the time, there was a very specific skill set that you learned, and it was hard to transition out of that and apply that elsewhere. So that was a very steep learning curve. I think the fact that I was able to kind of, you know, climb that learning curve pretty quickly just gave me, I think, honestly, an overconfidence that, you know, I could make any type of like big pivot. And I definitely got myself in over my head in many roles.
Okay,
you know?
Tell us one way.
I think one example is, you know, I was pretty comfortable in the SEO paid search kind of space in the ad agency world. I then made a big pivot in my role at Publicis and was overseeing part of what was called the search and data science team. And it was overseeing a team of engineers, data scientists, strategists, and search people. Search people, I got. All of the rest, I was like, I totally got it. I can manage engineers. I got, you know, I've worked with these people, and it was a big, you know, when we were working with natural language processing and scraping unsourced kind of public data sources, et cetera. And I'm supposed to be kind of overseeing this and architecting, you know, what that should all look like. Just wasn't a skill set that I had. I realized I was in over my head. I realized that, you know, team members and cross-functional teams were kind of looking to me to fill a gap that had been left there by someone who was much more senior than me, who really did have a significant background in this. It was tough. It was hard. It was also hard to, I think, I realized that, you know, also managing a team and not having the right skill set fit there, it was difficult to kind of get the respect of the team or to kind of get that team on board. And it was a big team that I was managing at its biggest, well, it depends on what you think is big, but for me, it was, you know, about 20 people. And that was also a big leap for me, right? I had managed maybe 5 people max to that point. So, you know, I was there for a few years and it ended up being an incredible experience for me, but it was definitely a challenge to kind of, and very stressful, very anxiety inducing, tough for my mental health for sure for a while.
So was this a time period where you were in that imposter syndrome-y thing or self-doubt?
Definitely.
And that, how did you get yourself enough out of that to actually stay for a few years and do the job?
Yeah, I think that I think my kind of core value in building a career is around relationship building. Mm-hmm. And so I know that I can always lean on that and that I can always make inroads by building relationships with those cross-functional team members, with those senior, you know, executives, with the people on my team, or at least some of them. Some of them were stubborn to, you know, developing these relationships and weren't happy about, you know, having a new boss in charge, et cetera. But I think that over time, I was able to kind of build this network of kind of safe spaces, I would say, with different people throughout the organization who were hyping me up and vice versa, and who I could lean on for support, or I could lean on to help make my job a little bit easier because they know I'm going to be a good partner to them. They'll be a good partner to me and so on. And so I actually think it's about, for me, has always been about kind of building this network that helps me kind of believe, yeah, I'm where I should be. These are my people.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a lot of patience in that process.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing is, like, I'm also just stubborn. I am, you know, I've also got a lot of female rage. And so something that drives me, you know, is I think if I don't feel respected, if I don't feel like I'm getting the respect that I deserve, I'm going to fight to get that respect. I'm going to fight to, you know, show my value. And so I think that's kind of another piece that drives me. So it is, there's patience in that process, but there's also this, you know, like little seed of like, you know, that kind of can help fast forward that process too.
Taryn, what's a time in your career where you felt in over your head?
Yeah, I had been in the professional skincare space for a long time, which is something that I'm really comfortable in. And I got approached by a capital equipment or energy-based device company. So completely different realm, but still within the medical aesthetic field. And they wanted to employ me to task bringing their skincare brand to light that would complement and partner with all of the energy-based devices and treatments we were providing to physicians. And to me, I was like, oh, I got this in the bag. Like, they already have capital equipment all over the U.S.
When you say capital equipment, what does that mean?
So any laser technology, but we also had surgical technology too, everything from hair regrowth to, you know, also sexual health and wellness technology and other things like that. So it's just kind of dependent on where the physician wants to go. We had over 15 different devices we offered in the U.S. But a massive company, like globally massive company, 98 countries, like, you know, incredibly successful over the course of its last 25 years. And so I thought, oh man, like, I totally have this team of 56 underneath me, 4 regional managers, like, let's just keep going. I got it. Well, I thought what we were bringing to the market was something really intriguing and different for physicians. Unfortunately, a lot of them didn't fully understand or grasp the why behind it. It was a full spectrum CBD product, which actually has a lot of benefits to the skin and wound healing from services that are ablative. You know, so we had more struggles than we expected. And then the way that the business really worked, we had to be, I just didn't have like my team that was in charge of the consumable side of the aspect of the business. But I also had to manage the team that was on the capital equipment sales side. So we had about 450 on that side. Wow. And so I had to work with all the sales leads from there. And just to say in a pleasant way, everybody has a really big personality when you're in sales. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice way to put some certain things. it's the spin on it. But I definitely realized in my short time there, I thought I was going to be able to make a bigger impact and change really quickly, which was really hard for me to not see that happen. I'm driven off of results. I like to see it in sales. That's the only way that I like really see and measure success is for myself is like, oh, we have that number. I'm tied to that number. If I've hit it or exceeded it, then I've done a good job. Mm-hmm. And so what I really had to kind of learn was one, delegate. I was like taking on way too much. And it took me about 6 months to figure that out, that like things were getting left behind or weren't being done as well as they should have been. And then I think a real hefty dose of what I call like professional vulnerability. Mm. So a little bit to what you were talking about as well is truly being okay with the fact that I can't know it all, but finding the answer so that I understood it better from whatever facet that may be. So if I had to go to the clinical team and had a debrief on like exactly what happens in the ablation process and, you know, is water evaporating from the skin or are we actually burning the skin? Like which one is happening that's creating the result? And so it required a lot of work because I think as like sales reps or being in sales in general, you fear by saying like, oh, I'm not really that great at X, Y, and Z, that's going to be frowned upon by your leaders or your managers. And so for a while, it took a little bit of like adjustment to just be like, it is okay to ask. I will perform better in my role if I do so, alongside delegating what I don't need to be doing at the end of the day.
So I lead sales at Base Beauty, and I don't have a sales background. It's sort of like I've had to learn on the job. And I've noticed that like my self-esteem in my role is tied to what did I add to projections and like how am I building the pipeline? And on those weeks that I don't have great news or big news, I'm like actually sad, right? I would like to disconnect a little bit of my self-esteem from this, but how do you deal with those, you know, sort of if you see success in just the numbers, how do you buoy yourself when the numbers aren't good?
So I've learned to balance it a little bit with also seeing my team evolve in ways and areas that I need and can coach and mentor them in. A lot of my job and responsibility is also building better, well-rounded sales reps. And so I have found through like development calls with the team and doing peer-to-peer led influence where they can actually learn from each other of what's going on in the field, what objections are they coming over, and then actually getting to see them have those small little wins, even though it might just be a change in a talk track or how they asked for the close or what they implemented in this that had success, whether it actually has that monetary value tied to it or not. That's been extremely rewarding for me, especially in those challenging times where I'm just like, dang, like, how are we still short on this number? Like, I know you guys are out there grinding. I know I'm out there grinding. We're all doing the right things. It's just not coming together. It can be hard to detach from that. So I think it is important to like look out for what are those small little wins in a day to day? And then how can we celebrate those for each other? Because if I'm feeling it, my team is definitely feeling it. You know, they get told no 100 times a day from physicians when they're knocking on doors. And so it's like one little yes actually means a bit of success. Right. Yeah.
So Kelly, let's talk about the challenges you face as the general manager of Lola in the women's health space. Like what are the biggest obstacles that your team confronts on a daily basis?
Yes. So I think that some of the biggest challenges are, you know, Lola's 10 years old. This is our 10-year anniversary.
Yay!
Yay. You know, our founders had really found white space early on. And there was kind of no one else doing this in those 10 years, which I think is a good thing. A lot of other kind of clean and organic period care, sexual wellness, postpartum brands have emerged. And so I think one of our biggest challenges is, you know, there's plenty of market share to be had from the Tampaxes of the world. Tampax still owns the vast majority of the market. Even so, kind of managing what is our true differentiator. Early on, our differentiator was we are the organic cotton, you know, clean period care brand. What does that look like now? How are we evolving? What makes us unique from, you know, our other kind of clean care competitors? So that's one of kind of the biggest challenges I think that we grapple with. The other ones are, you know, I think less about kind of the category itself and more headwinds that are facing so many businesses, you know, paid media for direct to consumer are more and more expensive. And so how do you, as you know, a small to mid-sized kind of business with decent brand awareness in, you know, urban areas, but maybe less in rural areas, et cetera, how do you really grow your brand awareness in a cost-effective way? And so figuring out what are those levers to pull, figuring out how to pivot your marketing strategy in a way that, you know, no one really has those answers right now. We've all, you know, paid media was kind of the way to go for awareness, particularly for D2C and even other sales channels. And now we're kind of all trying to figure out how to navigate this new world together. And so I would say that's another one that we spend a lot of time thinking about.
So Taryn, tied to Kelly's, I'll call it innuendos about what's going on in the world. It's a really complicated place right now. And businesses can't plan, right? Because of we need to understand what's happening next to be able to plan as businesses. So there's a lot up in the air. So you have people literally like pounding the pavement, knocking on doors for, you know, products that make people better, but they don't have to have it, right? Mm-mm. So it's a little different than a pad or a tampon where like that is a necessity. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of reprogram your thinking or your talk tracks? I've never heard that word, but I'm going to use it now. To make this make sense for your team and your brand.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so we are in a massively competitive space. There's around 450 other professional brands that any physician can choose from. Our main channel of operation is slightly different from most. So we do have an end consumer facet to it, but we're always benefiting and trailing that back to the physician at Alumier. So in the way that I mean that is that if you're to go to our end consumer website and you're to purchase something, it actually, that sale, you'll be directly tied to the clinic that you select when you put in your zip code, and 50% of that profit, just as it would be from within the location, goes back to that physician. So then they can adapt that patient, they can acquire that patient in, and it's a way to cut down on cost for patient acquisition, which is around $600 per patient, which most medical spas can't afford. So we have a lot of like different marketing tactics that we deploy. I work really closely with our global head of sales, Casey, and her entire team. We have a US-based team, a Canadian-based team, a UK, Ireland-based team, and an emerging markets-based team. So our brand actually is from Canada, and we first distributed throughout the EU, UK, and Canada. Our largest markets are there. Our smallest market is actually in the emerging markets of some of the other parts of the EU and the US. The US is the newest market for Alumier. We've been around for 3 years. And so to your point too, we really have to drive through brand awareness at this point in time, and how to cut through that space is very different. A lot of the responsibility falls, of course, on marketing to have that influence over consumer behaviors and purchasing within it, that then drives a physician to say, oh, my patient asked for Alumier and I think I need to start carrying that in my clinic. And then the way that we're really able to kind of support that physician is help them understand what the value of professional skincare means. So people will go and drop, you know, $3,000 on an energy-based, you know, treatment, whether that be laser or microneedling, et cetera. Well, 80% of your overall skin health is what you use every single day, morning and night. So you can go drop all the money on the world on Botox, injectables, this or that. And yes, they will have some type of influence on the skin. Yes, you'll have about a 20% result that you can expect. But if you truly want to have that culmination of efforts, it has to be all the things combined into one, that real like 360 degree approach. So we try to arm our physicians through education and being able to provide these types of informative consultations that are extremely result driven for the patient. So it starts to shift their thinking from, oh, I I just want this to a, oh, I actually see why I need this and what benefit it has. And then I think when you start to think about the skincare spectrum, like as a whole, you know, our skin is the largest organ in our body and it is the last to receive any potential nutrients from what you ingest. That goes to water, that goes to food or anything else, that's going to supply the rest of your body. So it actually is probably the most malnourished part of your entire body. And so you have to start to think about what you apply every single day and what is it that you want to achieve from that? And also what is it that you want to leave out from that too? Because I mean, I'm sure everybody in this room, you know, we have a deodorant that we apply. We have like some type of body wash we apply. All of that does stick and absorb into the skin. Lotion, then whatever your skincare regimen is, how many steps that is. And, you know, are you applying a neck cream or that? So you have to just be really, I think, more mindful. And I think consumers these days are. So we really target that messaging through like our clean and effective platform that we have. And then also it's driven by that physician channel, which really builds credibility and trust with the patient, which is extremely important.
You both mentioned really having to lean on the marketing team to find those angles, those opportunities. In a time of, you know, I guess financial concern, you know, what we're all afraid of is that money gets pulled out of marketing, right? Mm-hmm. So gas in the tank is marketing. But so if you don't put the gas in the car can't run. Mm-hmm. So as leaders in your organizations, and we can start with you, Kelly, like mm-hmm. how do you push for where the money needs to go when sometimes mm-hmm. they're, we'll call them, some of them are desperate times?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think we're fortunate. So Lola was acquired about a year and a half ago by an organization, a holding company portfolio of brands called Lyra Collective. And so I'm very close with my boss, who is the CEO and founder of that collective of brands. And, you know, he doesn't have a marketing background. And so, you know, we spent, I think, the first 6 months, you know, of our relationship really working toward, you know, he's kind of a former consultant, a finance guy. And so me, I think really establishing an understanding of why not all marketing can be quantified, why it can't all be ROI driven, right? Even myself, I'm a data driven person. So that's tough for me. Like, I want everything to be attributable. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to show the ROAS on everything. But you simply can't, especially when it comes to awareness. It has to be the billboard that everyone sees. It has to be, you know, these kind of broader scale reaching eyeballs. And you just don't know if that's converting people or not. And so it was me trying to make a case for something that even I feel uncomfortable with, which might have kind of helped in, mm-hmm. in the case that, you know, we're on the same page here, but we got to do it. And so, yeah, I think we spent a lot of time in kind of that first 6 months, even a year, of trying to get on the same page there specifically. So there was buy-in already on, yes, we need to spend money on paid media or more kind of like clearly attributable channels. The argument, and I think this is often the case, was around awareness. But we were able to kind of get that buy-in with the argument that you can spend all day on kind of lower funnel, mid funnel channels, but you have to ultimately, to grow the business, you have to grow the pool of people who know what the business is, who have heard of the business, and they might have to hear about it 6 times, 10 times before they actually are ready to make a purchase.
Okay, Kelly, can you say that again a little louder?
And so, and to your point about saying it louder, it's something that internally you have to keep saying over and over again, right? And showing instances of that and showing examples and showing that without awareness on right now, you're not growing the pool and you're just hitting the same people and you're kind of maxing out how much you can grow. And so there is a data-driven way to kind of show, like, with the absence of that awareness spend, you're kind of pushing up on the boundaries of where you can get to.
So let's shift gears a little bit. I've been asking all my guests today about the books that are on their night table or in their devices, business books, health, wellness books. Taryn, we can start with you. Anything interesting that we should be reading?
You know, gosh, I wish I had a little bit more time to read. That would be great. I travel so much for the brand, which is great. And I love it. Don't get me wrong. My plane time is my go time. but I did just pick up like Chakram. I'm not sure if you guys have read it before, but it's like a yoga inspired book. It's not necessarily around wellness, but it's this like deep meditation journey book that's completely like you know, it's just, it's incredible. And I've already read it once before, but it's one of those like easy reads. And since I've read it, it's like, it doesn't feel overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I think right now, like after I finish a day worth of work, I'm like, gosh, I just need to do anything but what feels like a little bit of work to mm-hmm. me. And so I go out for a walk now that it's actually nice in New York, thank God. And that's like more my release, or I'll do some breath work mm-hmm. or I'll actually take a, like a class. So that's, I guess in some ways, my wellness journey is a little bit more of like my personal book that I'm building in my journal right now. That. Yeah.
What about you, Kelly?
Yeah. So my reading is definitely more for pleasure, you know, coming from book publishing, I was an English major. So I'm definitely kind of a like contemporary literary fiction, like brat, you know. And so I just finished Dream Count by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and now reading a book of essays. I can't remember what it's called, but all about kind of pop culture. There's a lot of like early like Tom Cruise references that are fun. Wow. But I think in terms of, you know, wellness, I get a lot of that from kind of industry news. What I've also started tapping into more is I think there are a lot of kind of up and coming, often female founded vendors like that are doing research as part of their overall kind of like building their business. And so there's a company I recently got to know called Highlight. They do a lot of product research, like physical product research at scale and at a much more cost-effective rate. And they do a lot of research on sustainability, on Gen Z, et cetera. And all of that folds into wellness and the wellness category. And so, or another company, I think they're called Statusphere, and it's a kind of micro influencer company, and they're doing research in that realm as well. So looking at some of these, you know, younger kind of startup companies on the vendor side that are doing research in the wellness space, who I think have a lot of kind of cutting edge insights that I've been looking at.
Yeah. Kristen, the founder of Statusphere, has been on the show.
Oh, great. Yeah, amazing.
She's a friend of ours.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we move off the book topic, I do want to acknowledge that Kelly is the author of a young adult book, Historical Heartthrobs, 50 Timeless Crushes from Cleopatra to
Camus.
Yeah. Yeah. When did you write this?
2013. So it's been a minute. Yeah. but yeah, super fun. I am a writer. I still write poetry, you know, a bunch of different, but this was nonfiction. So yeah, it's a nonfiction YA book. Find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. but very fun project. Yeah.
So now we're going to move on to our game, last phase of our show. So you both mentioned to us in our intake call that you love fitness and group fitness. Okay. So we're going to play a game, a class pass kind of game. Okay. So it's a this or that, which workout would you pick? Okay. Ooh, okay. So Taryn, we'll start with you. You can choose Aqua Studio, which is an underwater spinning.
Okay.
Or Fuse House, which is infrared heated mat Pilates and sculpting class. What are you going to choose?
Already at Fuse House. Yeah, already a member.
You love it.
On to all locations, including Miami. Can't wait for Hampton soon.
Okay, Kelly, is it Aqua Studio for you or Fuse House?
It's Aqua Studio. I've been there. Uh-huh. Yes. And it's a crazy experience. It was really, I'm a spin girl. I love to spin. I have a Peloton. It was a crazy experience and like really challenging, mm-hmm. but like where else can you do that? Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, so we'll start with Kelly on this one. Is it Humming Puppy Yoga? Custom soundscape blends sound frequencies to promote peak performance and concentration. Or you can go to the Nest, which is a trampoline cardio class.
Ooh. Oh, tough choice, right? I think I would do, I've done the trampoline thing. I think because I've done the trampoline mm-hmm. thing, which is cool, I'll do the Humming Puppy. I mean, that sounds delightful.
Okay. Yeah. Taryn?
I think it depends on my day. Can okay. I say, like, yes. if I have a lot of energy, trampoline, like mm-hmm. if I just want to get out some, like, you know, high level pump up.
Yeah.
But also when I'm feeling overwhelmed, I need like a settle and calm back down. So then I would choose yoga.
So I've done trampoline cardio. I really like it. I did it like a little bit after I had my second child, which mm-hmm. means I peed in my pants mm-hmm. each time. so that is a side effect of jumping up and down.
Trampolines can do that.
okay, next one. Surf Set NYC, which is balancing on a wobbly board for core strength, or Belly Queen, which is belly dancing for beginners. Let's start with Kelly.
Oh my God, another hard choice. I want to do both. I have, my dream is to surf. It's very like accessible. I could take a class, but I like haven't done it. So there's clearly something there I need to work through. But And so, again, I think I might choose the belly dancing. That's okay. Like, yeah, I'd love to have that skill. Yeah.
Taryn?
Surf.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounds so fun. I mean, I've done it once in Hawaii. It miserably ended with, like, coral in my foot and stuff. But this sounds like a safer alternative.
Yeah, I mean, you're on a wobbly board, so you're building core strength and balance, right? But you're, I would assume, not in the water. It's didn't mention anything about water here. Okay, our last one, which is AB Circ. Circus arts class or rumble boxing, fusion of boxing, strength training, and cardio. Taryn, we'll start with you.
I mean, I probably should say the aerial stuff because it's so natural to me, but I do love a boxing class. There's nothing that, like, it feels really good to just kind of, like, let it out, get some things moving. So I probably would go rumble boxing.
And Kelly?
I love rumble. Rumble is great. And so, again, because I've done it so much, I'm going to go with, like, circus, what is it?
Circus arts class.
Again, like, what a delay. That's a skill I would love to have.
So I've boxed, and also not on this list is the indoor rock climbing. And I find both of those really interesting for me because they're the two workouts that I can do where I absolutely positively can't think of anything else but that thing, right? Because with the boxing, they're like shouting out commands of like which hand to use and how to use it. And it's really, my processing on it is quite slow. I'm like, is that left or right? Like, you know, I have no idea. So my brain has to stay in it. And then the same with the rock climbing because it's so hard. It was like, I had this sort of like crazy experience my first time doing it, being like, oh my God, I just spent the last 15 minutes not thinking about anything else. And it was such a great way to clear my mind of all like work stuff and noise and all that stuff. So I really long for those workouts where I can escape the noise in my head.
That's spinning for me, actually. That's Peloton. My boyfriend does not have the same experience, but he also like is watching TV on his phone while he's doing it. And I'll like walk over and I'm like, what are you doing? You're supposed to be on like 40 resistance. Like, why are you like 25? But that's spinning for me where it's like, I'm like, let me, I got to max this out. I can't think about anything else.
What is one workout where you can't think about anything else?
I mean, it's actually quite a bit of them. I think because I work on meditation, it like really helps. And I think just from a gymnastics background, you're able to like cancel out any of the noise. Like otherwise you'll continuously be in this ever evolving, like real struggle with yourself that you haven't reached that level of perfection. So not to say I've mastered it. Trust me, definitely haven't. But you kind of can send yourself into a state where you can completely disconnect. But I always make it a rule. Like, I never bring a phone in with me. It's always in the locker because I don't want that distraction. If I have 50 minutes or 30 minutes, that's all I have in a day. That's truly to myself. And so I really value that time and that time alone. So,
good tip. Well, thank you, everybody. This is a great way to end this episode.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Where Brains Meet Beauty with Jodi Katz. Tune in again for more authentic conversations with beauty leaders.